revolution comes like thunder, and the age of hypocrisy is done.
Mayday, yes, this Mayday will build bridges to the millions across the globe as they resist Trumpian-style policies, where the rich get richer by exploiting and abusing we who do the work and create the wealth. Tuesday, May 1st, 3 to 7 p.m. Tune in and hear We the People in Motion on Mayday. Listen to the movers and shakers, the working masses putting the movement back into the labor movement. Mayday, Mayday, Tuesday, May 1st, 3 to 7 p.m. over WBAI, 99.5 FM. We're building bridges, produced by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Ah, New York City. Countless movies and TV shows have been shot here. And in all those movies, everyone's young and attractive. No one has a real job, but they all live in fabulous giant apartments on Park Avenue. That is not New York, okay? New York is loud, it's expensive, it's dirty. New York is a crowded subway that never shows up on time. That's New York. And with 13 million people here every day, everyone's got a different story. So tune in here every Thursday from 7 to 8 to hear me, Marie Faustin, share some of my stories and chat it up with some of my favorite storytellers from right here in the Melting Pot. Careful, it's hot. Every week we'll be serving up stories that'll have you laughing or crying or immediately booking a flight to the city that never sleeps. Don't worry, we'll leave the light on for you.
And it's just like we've decided there'd be some words we won't say all the time. And I was just trying to find out which words they were. I wanted a list, because nobody gives you a list. And all I could think of was motherfucker. That was my original list. I knew it wasn't complete, but it was a starter set, you know?
George Carlin in the 1970s. Now those seven words and more can be heard at WBAI's monthly benefit comedy show, Too Raw for Radio. It's Monday night, May 7th at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons at 388 Atlantic Avenue. A $13 admission includes a $3 credit for food and drink at the cafe. That's Too Raw for Radio Comedy Show, Monday, May 7th, 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons. And you can find us on Facebook at Too Raw for Radio.
And here's the list of words your dad and I don't ever want to hear you say. Hey, thanks, Ma. Boy, that's going to save me an ass-kicking or two. Ah! Oh.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
and good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, enchantment, and the imagination. And it would seem pouring rain on our rooftop. I hope you can hear it and enjoy it. My guest this morning, after what, 30 years or so of trying, Scott Edelman. Stay tuned. And good morning. So this is Hour of the Wolf. Hey, Max.
Who?
We have no internet connection, so the Facebook goes out in here. The Wi-Fi.
I can try to reboot it.
If you could, yeah, or I mean, why is it going?
It's been doing that the last day or two.
Yeah.
I hear the weather sometimes is a factor.
Not if you have a good modem. Or wireless, or whatever. Anyhow, I hope you all at home are enjoying this. I know I am. When did the and who ordered this weather? I didn't order this weather. I hope everybody can hear. I'm going to turn up my mic real loud. Okay. You know, they used to sell record albums called Environments. And they had ambient sounds, and you could pay for an hour of rain. They sold well.
Well, you have indicated that it has been 30 years of trying to get me on your program, and I am endeavoring to make sure it is indeed a trying evening.
Or
morning.
Yes,
or whatever
it is.
This is.
Yeah, well, we will... Okay, the internet keeps popping in and out. Yes, thank you. One of our viewers on Facebook said, stream or stream not, there is no try.
A little secret.
Yeah?
If Arrington doesn't work, try the commons.
This attaches to whatever is strongest near it.
You can't change it? So
yes, I can, only by stopping the show and... You know,
I can tell you how to make it work.
And Carlin-ing around for...
I'll tell you how to grouse.
Yes.
I'm telling you, connect to the cabinets.
Yeah, I've done that in the past. I probably already am. Somebody's saying, was that Max? No, that was Max. Wave at the camera, Max. No, other side. Near Scott.
We're not looking at you.
Down, yet. Down. No, we're not looking at me. Uh-huh. I have a guest. Max Scott. Scott Max.
How are you?
We've already spoken.
Oh, okay.
His T-shirt is drawn by Bob Eggleton, a friend of mine, a Facebook, the artist Bob Eggleton, famous Monsters Godzilla there.
Okay.
So
you see Max Scott here.
Yes.
Would know people like Scott Eggleton.
Bob Eggleton.
Bob, I'm sorry.
Hugo winning artist.
Hugo winning artist. But you know him where? From Marvel or from?
Well, he drew for me when I was editing Science Fiction ages ago.
Ah, okay. Which you did for about 7 years.
Just from being in science fiction fandom.
Yeah. So why don't you tell the listeners, who am you?
Oh,
aside from being Scott Edelman,
I am Groot. You know
oh,
that.
God. I just watched a wonderful YouTube video earlier of the actor, I forget who it is, doing the voice linking of I Am Groot in about 7 languages for all the different versions that were guarding the galaxy.
Well, do you know I actually had to be Groot a few years ago at the Nebula Award ceremony?
No, I did
well,
not.
Well, I was called upon to accept the Nebula Award when, I guess, Guardians of the Galaxy won the Nebula, the screenplay won for best screenplay, and they came to me and said, would you accept it, but we only want you when you come on stage saying, oh, the producers couldn't be here, there were a few words they wished you to say. And I go on stage, and I open the piece of paper, and I look at it, and all I said was, I am Groot.
Okay.
Several times, and then held the trophy aloft and walked. So I did actually get to be Groot on behalf of Guardians of the Galaxy folks.
Oh, that's
but that is not the only thing. I go way, way back. I started working at Marvel Comics in 1974. I was on staff for several years, wrote Captain Marvel. Ton of other things.
You wrote her as a guy.
No, well, yes, that's true. But, well,
yeah.
Well,
so you weren't woke.
No one was woke back then.
No,
I don't think so.
No, I was on 5 to 7 a.m. Then, so I certainly wasn't woke.
You know. However, something I only learned a few months ago. I don't know how many comic book people there are in the audience, but villain,
there are more than a few.
All right. Well, a villain I co-created with artist Alan Milgram in Captain Marvel number 50 will be appearing in the Captain Marvel movie March, which I discovered when all of a sudden, as you know, writers are very egotistical and we always have ourselves on alerts for Google whenever our names are mentioned. One morning I was getting all these alerts that my name was being mentioned. Well, it was because an actress, Gemma Files, was from the show Humans, had been cast as Dr. Minerva. And will be the villain against the current Captain Marvel, played by what? Brie Larson, is that?
Yes.
In the next movie.
I'm sure, now, how is Gemma involved?
She was cast as the villain that I created in Captain Marvel number 50.
I know Gemma.
She's the star of the Humans, one of the stars of the... Well, no, Gemma Chan, I'm
Thank
sorry.
Thank you. Jeez.
Gemma Chan, yes.
Gemma Files is a science
That's
fiction
what it
writer.
That's would be very interesting if a
writer.
Science fiction writer had
yes.
been cast. Well,
I mean, she's very photogenic.
Yes, yes. But no, Gemma Chan.
Excuse me.
But, you know, I did Marvel Comics for a while. I wrote for DC Comics as well. Wrote a couple of Supergirl adventures, wrote a lot of House of Mystery, House of Secrets stories, all those spooky things that weren't quite as spooky as EC Comics.
Right.
Moved on.
Did you ever write for EC?
No, I was not. I was just born at that time, I think.
Well.
In the early 50s, they were not willing to hire me in the diaper, unfortunately.
Ah.
No.
Here they were for me. I pretty much started working on
a
diaper.
My fandom. I mean,
I was an adult.
Yes.
No.
Well, fandom is responsible for everything that's happened to me. I was at the EC Fan Attic Convention in 1972 when I met Bill Gaines and all the artists and writers at the time. But my first comic book convention was in 1970 when I was 15, and that was the beginning of everything, and I've been to thousands of conventions since then, as you probably have. So it started
less
from,
now than I used to. I mean, in about 1980, I figure, in 1980, I attended over 30 conventions in the 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And sometime after that, I started weaning myself. So now I do about 3 a year.
Yeah, I probably did it no more than 15, so you've got me beat with that. But fandom was where I began. Then I moved into comics. Then there was a time when I said I want to get out of comics because they say you should never see the sausage being made or be too involved in something you love.
Uh-huh.
And I went to the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop in 1979 saying, help, I want to not write comics anymore. I want to focus on science fiction and fantasy and horror and all that. And then I was just focusing on my own writing. Then I edited a series of magazines, starting with Last Wave in the 80s and then Science Fiction Age from 1992 to 2000.
I have a number of issues of Science Fiction
and,
Age.
And I was very pleased that we had someone win a Nebula Award the very first year, Martha Sukup, for a defense of the social contract, and someone won a Nebula the last year I was editing the magazine, Married to Zillow, for Mars Is Not for Children. So I was bookend.
I remember that story.
It was very nice to see stories that I edited, and other stories were nominated, but those were the two winners. And then I switched over and worked for the Sci-Fi Channel for 13 years, editing a series of websites for them, Science Fiction Weekly, Sci-Fi Wire, Blaster, and so forth. And in the last 3 or 4 years, I've been devoting myself to writing, which may explain why I was finally able to sell a story to Analog after 44 years of submitting stories. I still have the rejection slip that actually was a letter. It was not even a slip, giving me the wrong idea of what my relationship with editors would be. A letter from Ben Bova in 1972 rejecting that first submission to them.
And Ben was always very good about that.
Yes, it was a wonderful letter, and I was not
successful. He did have first readers. If the first reader didn't like it, you got the slip.
Yes.
But if it went on to Ben, he almost always wrote something.
And it was a wonderful letter, and I did a post about this on my blog because at one point it came to pass that I wanted to sell that story in Analog, less to sell a story in Analog than to let people know you should never give up. You should just keep trying and keep writing, and you should find joy in the process. So to be able to tell people after 44 years, then 4 months later, I sold the second story in Analog and had two of them come out in 2017.
Yes, one of our viewers, by the way, who's obviously, and I know her name, a ReaderCon person, said, "Oh my God, Scott's there. It's not just a cardboard cutout."
Yes, to explain to listeners what the cardboard cutout means, I was the first person to mail a check to a convention called ReaderCon, which began in 1987. I had gone every single year, and then there came a point maybe 4 or 5 years ago when my job for the Sci-Fi Channel intervened because I had to go to the San Diego Comic-Con and cover it, and the two conventions were moving forward and back a week, and they happened to be the same weekend, and I knew I would be depressed that a convention I'd been at for 27 consecutive years without missing, I would have to miss.
And I given a choice between the two, you'd probably
Well, I had to keep my job. But I would be so sad missing all my friends. So what I did is I had a life-size cardboard cutout of me made, mailed it to my friend Paul DiFilippo. I said, "Tell no one what's happening here. I want you on the opening day of the convention to put this in the registration area with a little sign saying, 'Scott will be very depressed this weekend. Please take a selfie with Scott and email it to him or use a hashtag, Scott Edelman ReaderCon or something.'" And what this meant is, well, I was working 20 hours a day at the San Diego Comic-Con all day. Photos were appearing of me at ReaderCon. They brought me on stage during opening ceremonies. They brought me on stage during closing ceremonies. And I was able to laugh my way through that. And
also during the Meet the Pros party,
where
everybody gets a sticker for a quote. It's a great icebreaker to do that. And everybody was, all the writers who had stickers quoting some of their works, put a sticker on your cardboard cutout.
Yes, oh, it's a wonderful concept, and I wish other conventions would follow it. Many conventions have
icebreakers. I wish ReaderCon would follow
it. Yeah, I mean, many people have icebreakers.
Because the last couple of years, they've been doing the party, they do the Cordwainer Smith Awards and the introduction of the guests of honor, and then they go into a dance party. And as a result, you don't really get to do much more than the stickers.
Well, wasn't the dance party the second night? Well, whatever. I think the dance party...
The second night was actually Kat Valenti and her variety show.
Ah, that would be Saturday night. Well, in any case, the thing about the stickers is they're attempting to give people a reason to talk to those who might give them squee, and they might be embarrassed or ashamed or hesitant to go up to. You may have an icebreaker party situation, but that doesn't mean you're going to cross the room and talk to Neil Gaiman or whoever it happens to be. But if every single writer has a set of stickers with quotes on it, and you have a sheet of wax paper, and you're supposed to go around like a scavenger hunt to every single writer there and collect the quote, that forces you. So
it's a great concept.
It's good because you know, there are, I mean, we have introverted people and people who might not feel comfortable stepping up to professionals, or and it's good to give them a reason that even if you have nothing else to say, you can say, "Oh, may I please have your quote?" And
yeah.
So it's a wonderful idea. But anyway, so now I can say I've been to, I think, 29 and a half of those reader cons.
I think you can say that you, in many ways, you attended that reader con
even
more than any. You appeared in more photographs that
year. That is true, and it is sad to say there were some people the next year who said we would rather you had sent the flat Scott than the one who showed up this year. But unfortunately, I had a disappointment.
As long as you didn't bring any exotic fruits.
I do that. I am known for offering people durian.
I actually have a video.
Yes, I believe. Was it the ReaderCon or BalticCon? I guess it was. It was probably.
It was a ReaderCon because I haven't gone to a BalticCon in a few years. More is the pity because I really like BalticCon. But you. I remember in the middle of a big all con party. You were walking around with the durian. Somebody else had a machete.
Well, I would never walk around. It should be clear to anyone
in
the audience
who
knows what a durian is. If you were in the Philippines with a durian, there would be a no symbol around a durian in hotels. You know how if you're in a hotel and it'll say if you smoke in this room, it will cost you $250 in order to have it fumigated? Well, it's the same thing with durians. Durian is not allowed on the subway. I believe the smell of an unopened durian, it's just like a ripe cantaloupe, an extremely has a nice fruity smell, but once you once you crack open the durian, if it's a truly ripe durian, there was one I did fall back from as if it were a baby's diaper.
You had two, and
one was riper than another.
One was riper than another, and one I actually sort of I thought it was sort of a vanilla, cantaloupe-y kind of a thing, and I didn't mind at all. Then the other was opened, and I tasted it, and it's like, oh, my God.
Well, and I should point
out, I'd rather have rotten camembert.
I will blame someone who perhaps might have been a past guest, Paolo Bacigalupi. I don't know if he was ever on the show, but
the
author Paolo Bacigalupi and I were having dinner at, I think it was the Nebula Awards ceremony in Washington, D.C. He was visiting, and he would be at Balticon the following week. And we were horrifying John Joseph Adams, an editor, edits Lightspeed and a variety of other things.
I work for John.
Yes, you work for John. Well, John's, let me say, his culinary tastes are limited, or were limited back then. He seemed to be a hot dog, hamburger, pizza guy. And we were describing all the various things we'd eaten around the world. And the subject of a durian came up, and I said, oh, Paolo, you're going to be in town a week from now for Balticon. I will obtain durian, and we will have a durian tasting. So I gathered people out in the parking lot. You'd never do this in a hotel because you would clear the hotel out. And we all ate durian, had a machete, and I also was kind enough to bring a jug of water and breath mints.
Yes.
As we handed them out.
And what was amazing, to the great credit of the hotel, is that the security people look in their camera and see that there is a bunch of strange people outside the hotel, one of whom is carrying a machete, and these round objects that are being hacked away and passed around, and a security guy comes out and he watches it, and bless him, his entire reaction was, don't I get a taste?
Yes, well, that was at ReaderCon, and the first one was at Balticon, and what has happened now is people say, oh, I missed the durian tasting. Can you please do it again? So I've done it three or four times, but it can only be done at hotels that have a parking lot. You really cannot do it in a hotel. And for instance, upcoming Balticon, which is in the Inner Harbor, there is really nowhere. You're not going to be on the street, a public street, hacking at one of these things.
Yeah.
So
I have found, by the way, in Sunset Park, I took a photograph of it, but I should see if I can get it more for you. Durian ice cream.
Yes, durian ice cream. I've had durian candies. I'm going to attempt to cook durian Oreos. Meanwhile, all these people are listening saying,
duck.
I thought this was a show about science fiction and fantasy,
but you also do a podcast.
That's right.
That's about
that's
food.
That's right. Well, it is
science fiction and food.
It is sort of about food. I would say Fran Wild and Elliot de Bodard do a podcast that is truly about food because all their questions are about food. They do one called Cooking the Book, so I'll put in a plug for them. It's a wonderful show. But I do one called Eating the Fantastic, and the food is more a loosener of the tongue. I have 60...
Hopefully just the tongue, yes.
And there have been ones we've eaten tongue, but not the tongue of the guest. And because since I was 15, my first convention, the convention away from the convention is as much, if not more fun than the convention itself when you take your friends and go out to eat. I thought, well, there are so many science fiction podcasts where people are sitting like this and talking that I needed a hook. I need to be something different. And since I am considered someone who knows the best places to eat at conventions, someone actually called me the Anthony Bourdain of science fiction, which is a bit of a stretch. But I said, okay, my podcast.
No,
will be...
I think you have better taste.
Yes, well, I'm going to take someone out for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, and we will sit, and the episode lasts as long as the meal lasts, and people are often more relaxed as they're sitting and eating than they are with the big microphone in front of
but
them.
But I know that when I leave a hotel, go during a convention to get some food, and I find that you're already there with a group of people at another table, I have found the right restaurant.
I know. It is very funny that that has happened. I've seen people walk in like, oh, look, Scott's here. I guess we picked the right restaurant.
Yeah, so, we went to the soup dumpling place near
that's
Capclave.
Right, during ball, yes.
It was Capclave.
Capclave, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, so I do. Sometimes I wonder. Do I
my
go
last Balticon was 30 years ago.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. Well, I sometimes wonder, do I go to science fiction conventions and that the food, is someone being murdered in the next room? Is that what our fear is?
It
well, I write
like
horror
a,
also, you see.
It
so
sounds like
be,
a baby crying, yes. So the management of the station must be
or
around.
It could be the audience is crying listening to all this, but... you know, or do I basically there happens to be a convention while I go seek out restaurants, which comes first, the restaurant or the
Ooh.
Convention? You know, that's always the difficult thing.
Yeah. Now, before we actually start talking about science fiction
yes.
and stuff like that, there I need to promote, and I'm going to do that now. The next New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which is a monthly event that is generally the first Tuesday of every month. If you were present for our last one, we had Chandler Klang Smith and a colleague of yours, or former colleague of yours, who's going to be our guest next week, Chris Claremont, who I think he writes comic books.
Yes, he does. We worked in the Marvel bullpen in the mid-70s,
yeah.
A long time ago.
Yeah. He told me that the only movie made with Marvel characters in which he has not had a character is Black Panther.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And I said, Guardians of the Galaxy? He said, I created Star-Lord.
Hmm.
I don't remember what book he created Star-Lord for, but it wasn't Guardians. It's that he created Star-Lord. That particular book died, and somebody else said, oh, this is a cool character. Let's use him and put him into Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, the Guardians of the Galaxy that we know of in the movies are not the same ones as the comics, but that's sort of an all. If you
well,
go
not,
back to the
none
beginning,
of them.
If you go back, it's a different group.
Anyhow, that was last month, or this month. We're still in April. May 1st, May Day. Good God, there really is serious noise.
I'm hoping no one else can hear the mayhem that is occurring elsewhere in this building.
Yeah. Is it in the building? Is it outside the building?
Well, you do know I've written so many zombie stories. That wherever
oh,
I
that,
go,
that's it. It's
zombie
the horde.
Follows. Yes,
it's the screaming
yes,
horde.
Yes.
Okay, but our next one is on May Day. And we have two very, very, very cool writers. Alana C. Meyer has worked as a journalist in Jerusalem and a cultural critic for various publications. As Alana Teitelbaum, she has written book reviews and critical essays for The Globe and Mail, The Los Angeles Review of Books, Salon, and The Huffington Post. Last Song Before Night was her first novel, followed by Fire Dance, which is relatively decent. She lives in New York. Joe Walton does not live in New York. She's very hard to get here, but happily will be here on May 1st, and she will be our other reader that evening, 7 o'clock. She has published 13 novels, with a 14th Lent due out from Tor in the spring. Her novel, among others, won the Hugo and Nebula in 2012. Her blog posts about older SF have been collected in a volume called What Makes This Book So Great? And she's just published a collection of short stories, poetry, and a play called Starlings, which came out of Tachyon Publications. She comes from Wales, but lives in Montreal, and her plan is to live to be 99 and write a book every year. So this is May 1st, 7 p.m., 388 Atlantic Avenue. Admission is free, but if you do not donate on your way in, we will pout. Now, it's not donating actually to BAI. It's donating to the reading series because we buy meals for our readers and we pay rent. So, well, we owe rent. Let's be more precise about this, shall we?
Good to know you have journalistic integrity and state things the way they are.
Yeah, I'm the one here. No, that's not fair. Don't we have democracy now? And all kinds of shows that have integrity from WBAI. So that was the promo that I needed to do. But May 1st, please be here. Same building that we're currently in, but we're on the third floor. Come to the first floor. You'll see it. It's a lovely cafe. And it also streams live. And by the way, if you're listening and you want to watch what we are doing, you can go to Facebook Live and go to my timeline, it's all the food talk. My Time Lemon, Jim
Time
Freund,
Durian.
Freund. Ooh, there's a good Time Durian. Now that sounds like the title of a franchise, doesn't it now? The Time Durium series. And then they can have Time Durian Infinity and kill everybody off.
Well, when you taste a durian, you do feel as if time has stopped. So
yeah, there is that.
It really makes sense.
There is that. I have not forgotten that. Do you have a video of that? I do.
Yes, there is a video online.
Yeah.
I believe that Jamie Todd Rubin recorded the Balticon one, the first one.
And I recorded the ReaderCon one.
So that they are
not very good. I mean, this camera now is very good. But at that time, I had a cheap little phone.
Well, we'll have to do it again.
Yeah, well, we should consider that. Are you going to ReaderCon this year?
I will be there.
So shall I. Okay, good. So now that we're half an hour into the show, I've been asking you for years to be on the show. And you didn't want...
Decades. I wanted to be live.
Literally. You want to, and so you are.
Though why someone who has written so many zombie stories would want to do something live, I don't quite understand, because so many of the characters I write about are not live.
Mm-hmm.
But yet somehow I said, no, unless I can make it there into the studio, I don't want to record at a convention, which you were certainly willing to do, but... So,
And I should mention, by the way, that it is well known to most people that I am not a big fan of horror and zombie-like things. I've never seen an episode of Walking Dead and stuff like that there. But I attended a reading of yours at the KGB Fantastic Fiction series, which is the other fine, great monthly series of science fiction and fantasy writers in New York. And you read a zombie story there that I just thought was top-notch, that I thought was great. Good literature, good characters, and just a really great story.
I appreciate that. Well, that would have been the story called What Will Come After, which is the title story of a collection of mine. made up entirely of zombie stories.
Okay. This is the one about the husband working his way home.
Well, that is the one. When Pete Crowther, PS Publishing, was doing a collection, he said, well, you must do a new story for the collection because that entices folks who have already read every one of your stories to purchase the collections. I said, okay, I'll do something new for you. And I said, well, I've done everything that could possibly have been done with zombies. I actually have a zombie play called The Plague on Both Your Houses that is a Shakespearean play, sort of a cross between Night of the Living Dead and Romeo and Juliet in blank verse with a nurse and a gravedigger, and they got the whole Shakespearean thing. That was my first...
With a zombie named Iambic Pentameter.
And that was my first Bram Stoker Award nomination back in 1999. But I've done so many different things, and I said, if I'm going to push the envelope, what should it be? Well, the only thing I could do is if I wrote a story about what will happen after I die and come back. So all of the facts of my life, such as they are in that story, my parents, my wife, my son, etc., etc. And the premise of that story is, with the zombie plague coming, my wife and I decide we have to part, because if one of us were to die, that person would want to eat the other person, so therefore we had to separate. And when I do finally die, I then wander through West Virginia and Maryland in search of my wife for reasons that are disclosed at the end of the story. No, I consider it a love story.
Let's not do the reveal.
It is a love story. But everything in there, all the aspects about where I live, the description, it's a tough story to read because it is in a future tense. I'm describing a future that has not happened yet. And one of the things I say in that story about how grateful I am that...
And I like that, a future that hasn't happened told by a person who's now dead.
Yes. I was trying to push my talents with that story and push the envelope.
I think you succeeded, yeah.
But it's a tough story to read because at the time I wrote the story, I was saying things like, I was very glad that my parents were deceased and did not live to see the zombie apocalypse happen. And to read that story aloud when your parents are alive is easier than to later on read that story and come to the passage when you talk about your parents being dead. It has a different emotional weight for yourself personally. Anyway, so all the stories I have done, and you can read me and not care about zombies because I've published nearly 100 stories now.
Wow.
I would say, maybe 15 of them are about zombies. I have a fascination with them.
Yeah.
But it would be possible to only read my science fiction and still have read, 40 stories. And, it would be very easy for you to just pick and choose. And it's very funny that audiences do that. There are some people who just, I like your voice, so I will go wherever you are. And there are other people who will only read the science fiction, only read the horror, or only read the fantasy. So that means for some audiences, I've only published 30 stories because they haven't gone, you do that other thing. Oh, you wrote comic books too? Things. So there are people who might only know you for one aspect of the personality. Now I imagine there are people who listen to the podcast and say, you write also? But that all comes up as I discuss my life and the lives of my guests. But
yeah, no, that, you know. I would say that's fairly apparent in Eating the Fantastic.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. Well, I know when you've been to conventions for so many years, I'm 15 years old, I basically walk into a ballroom, as you must after all these years, and say, there are 500 or 600 people here. And while I am not friends with them all, I at least recognize 95% of them. So there is this family feeling about it. So often there are guests. I had a guest on the show, Marv Wolfman, comic book writer and editor, who I've known since 1971 when I got his autograph as a 16-year-old kid, and he was just a beginning comic book writer. I did an episode with Barry Malzberg. I did an episode with many people who I met in my early days of fandom. I did an episode with William F. Nolan, who turned 90 years old this year.
Did he? Bless
him. Yes, who most people know from having written the book, co-written the book with George Clayton Johnson of Logan's Run. He's done so much more, but that was a wonderful
interview.
He's
done a lot, actually.
Yeah, so much more. Twilight Zone and things with Richard Matheson and many movies and so on. But anyway, so often when I'm sitting down with old friends, but I often very much try on that podcast to shine a light on the new voices of the show, people who are wonderful new writers, people like, you know, Mala Al-Mohtar and Alyssa Wong,
Sarah Pinsker,
A. Mark Rostad, and so forth. So I want it to be a mix of old voices and new people who I like, whose work I like, who people should know more of. So I don't just want it to be old friends and new friends yet to be made.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fun. Hopefully we don't chew too much on the podcast, but
yes, but I was going to make some, I don't know, clever statement about chewing over ideas, but it's a better idea not to.
Well, we do that. Yeah. But hopefully sometimes people even forget they're on the show. I mean, here you and me, we're sitting in the studio. Yes, we're old friends. We've known each other 30-something, 35, however, when the first time we saw each other, I don't remember. But there still is, we're surrounded by computers and microphones and this camera here that's putting us live on Facebook. So they're always in the back of your mind. That's, oh,
a little cockeyed, I might say.
I'm always that way. But if you're with someone at a restaurant, they have clip-on mics and the recording equipment is under the table. It's just, we're sitting here eating. No one really knows what's going on. I think it's very relaxed for the guests. And people do seem to like the atmosphere. So I know science fiction has been very, very good to me. And that's just one way to help give back, you know, save some of those voices.
Yeah, yeah. But it's a very different kind of slant on how to do it. It's a very different way.
Yeah, well, it's as if you're eavesdropping. You pull up a table and it's Eating the Fantastic. It's on the iTunes store. You can or just eatingthefantastic.com. And you'll find
I always like to tell people non-Apple sources for...
Well, just go to eatingthefantastic.com or scottelman.com and click on the photo of me eating a hamburger.
Yes.
And that will take you to all the episodes.
Yeah, I would actually encourage people to go to scottedelman.com because that is a portal to many things, Scott Edelman.
Oh, it has all my comic books. I didn't even mention that I wrote some episodes of Tales from the Dark Side.
That's right.
As well, which was all very... So much in my life has happened by accident. Working at Marvel Comics happened by accident. Writing the television shows happened by accident. I'll tell you briefly how that happened. This was very strange. One day, I get a letter in the mail from a guy named Tom Allen. Not Tim Allen, the actor, but Tom Allen, who was a story editor from Tales from the Dark Side, who said, I was in the science fiction store Forbidden Planet, which at one point was across the street from the Strand. I don't know if it's still there, if it moved slightly to a different location.
It's moved slightly, but it's...
And I happened to pick up...
Kitty Corner.
I happened to pick up a copy of a magazine you're publishing and editing called Last Wave. And these are the pre-internet days. We had read some of your comic book stories for House of Mystery and House of Secrets and think you would be good to do stories for Tales from the Dark Side. Are you the same Scott Edelman who wrote comic books? If so, get in touch. Just think that someone had to, on dead tree paper, type a letter and mail it to me to find out if I were the same person. They couldn't tweet at me or Facebook at me. And I said, yes, I am. And I was astonished that when I went in and had a meeting with this guy, he pulled out a reader's report of a memo to George Romero, the guy who was one of the co-creators of Tales from the Dark Side, who we know from Zombiehood, Night of the Living Dead, saying, we just read this comic book story by a guy named Scott Edelman called My Ghost Rider the Vampire, which would be a perfect episode of Tales from the Dark Side. And they said, yes, get in touch with them. Of course, I didn't own that because comic books were purchasing all the rights, but DC Comics was kind enough to split whatever money came in with me, and I did the stories for several additional episodes as well. But that is all serendipity. It is all an accident, just because some guy named Tom Allen happened to see a copy of Last Wave across the way, and It's probably serendipity that caused me not to do more TV work, because sadly Tom Allen passed away.
Mm.
Tom Allen was accepting, I would say, one out of three ideas that I was sending his way. And when he passed away, the new guy, I came up with maybe 10 or 15 of them that I would write up in treatment for him, and he didn't like any of them. And I said, well, boy, I could have written a whole bunch of short stories with the energy that I've been wasting to do this. Obviously, it's not clicking. I wasn't particularly happy with the results of what appeared on the screen, because TV people are very fingers on and messing with what you're doing, and changing the things that you do. In fact, there was one episode that they did which they added an African-American character that I was so horrified by. It was almost an old 1940s movie, Step and Fetch It, character sweeping up in a store. And I almost took my name off that one. I was trying to figure out, can I put one of those Cordwainer Bird, the way Harlan Ellison would when he was not happy with it. And at that point I said, no, when I do a story, generally the editors of fiction, they'll take it because they pretty much want it that way. Any changes that occur in the story because they saw something you should have seen anyway. I mean, they've been very lucky. I mean, I will take editorial direction, but a good editor will not make it their story. A good editor will say, oh, there's something you missed. And you will go, oh, my goodness, if only I'd realized that. Thank you so much. That's the kind of editor you want that saves you.
Or says, put this incident elsewhere.
Yeah, it's not someone who says, take the woman and make her a man, and we don't want it to be a dog. You know, make it a cat, and, by the way, set it here. Don't do pyramids. Set it in Italy instead. You know, some editors will do that. That's what they do in TV, it seems. They find one little nugget.
It would seem that way.
Yeah, which is basically what happened with the first episode I did, but the second episode I did. This connects with last week's guest that you had on the show, Gordon Linzer.
Who bought a story.
It is not the fifth story, I think, that was made into the show, but I published a story in Space and Time called The Floater, about a person for whom gravity worked for everyone in the world but him. So he would just sort of start floating off. He would have to hold his hand on desk, wear a seatbelt when he went to bed, and the psychiatrist, and I transformed this into a treatment, how it would work, and they loved the treatment, and they said, okay, we only want one change, have him living at home with his mother, because it's television, you can't just be thinking all the time, we need to have him having conversations with people. In fact, his whole house was a spider web of rope, because he would have to pull himself along. Anyway, so they loved the treatment, they bought it. And then when the script, I did not get to do the final script. Someone else did the final script. And when I received a copy of the final script, I'm reading it. I said, they must have sent me the wrong script, because the first 5 or 10 pages take place at the U.S. Army recruiting station and people playing war games. And then some guy runs in, oh, I escaped from a circus where I'm being held captive because gravity doesn't work for me and I float and so forth. Well, what happened, I guess, is they liked the concept and they said, well, we like the concept. We want to do something different, but we can't not buy it, because then we will.
Because you'd sue.
He'll say, wait a second, I gave you it, you just changed it. So basically they took the story, changed almost all of it. My name is still on the screen. I can't recall who did the final script. It's story by
Now, which show is this?
Tales from the Dark Side.
Oh, this is from Dark Side.
And they changed it from The Floater to Fear of Floating. And what horrified me again is I had written, and I'm trying desperately to remember my ending to the story, but it was a bittersweet ending, sort of the ending of the Burgess Meredith episode where his glasses break.
Yes.
It's not a horrifying episode. It's sort of, you're grown a bit and you're sad for the guy. My ending to this story was sort of like that, and I can't remember exactly what it was. They changed the ending to the guy who's walking around in these lead boots in the U.S. Army Recruiting Service is told, well, you're cured now, you can take the boots off. So he takes the boots off, he seems to be cured for a second, and then he floats up and you hear someone going, oh, watch out for that ceiling fan. And
yeah,
all of a sudden,
God,
the person looking up is getting blood splattered in his face in a rhythmic, and then it ends. So it went from a story that was going to be
why I didn't watch Tales from the Dark Side.
Yeah.
Because they did stuff like that.
Yeah, so I basically said, okay, this is not what I should be doing. I should stick to the stories and, have editorial jobs and other jobs that will allow me to write the stories I want to write and have them published pretty much the way I choose to have them published. I mean, people make little changes here and there that they request, and sometimes they're okay, and sometimes I don't make them, and they're okay if I can justify not making them, and I'm quite happy. As I said, I'm up to, I think I've had 93 or 94 published and another 5 or 6 in the pipeline about to be published.
So okay, that's pretty good.
So I'm coming up on 100. I don't know which one will
be. But how many books? How many of these are bound?
Well, I published one novel called The Gift, which was published in 1990 by last
Gordon
week's
Linster.
Guest. Which was only a novel by accident. I was thinking about that recently because I was reading an article in Locus.
I have a copy.
And in Locus, someone said, well, you're planning on writing a novel. And I don't plan on writing a novel. That novel started as a 2,500-word short story. That was the first draft. The second draft was about 10,000 words, and the third draft was about 30. So the stories or whatever the stories are going to be. But I have several short story collections, the zombie one called What Will Come After, a collection of my son, and then this is one just of my general horror and fantasy called These Words Are Haunted.
Mm-hmm.
I have a science fiction short story collection called What We Still Talk About that collects a whole bunch of science fiction stories, many that were in anthologies published by Daw Books. And just last year, I published a mini collection of zombie novelettes called Liars, Fakers, and the Dead Who Eat Them. And one of those stories was nominated for a Stoker last year. My eighth.
All right, so hold that closer
my
to
my eighth
the,
Stoker
to the
nomination.
Up a little. Up a little. There we go. Very good.
And by the way, I am
That's
the
a great
Susan
title.
Lucci of the Horror Writers Association.
Ah,
no
okay.
one has been nominated more times without ever having won. And it is very perverse of me in that 2 years ago, when I was nominated for the sixth time, I was tied with three other writers at 0-6. No, 6-0? I don't remember how baseball would do it. Six nominated, 6-0,
Batting 0 for 6
and
at
when
bats, yeah.
they were going to announce the winner, I was not sure if I wanted to win. I was in the audience, because if I won, I would be one of many people who had won Stoker Awards. You could look around, oh, he won a Stoker, she won a Stoker, that person won a Stoker. But if I were to lose, it would be historic. And in fact, the Toastmaster, Jeff Strand at the time, as part of the opening ceremony, said, you've all seen Scott Ullman wearing a six-time loser button, which I had made up. And he said, I want everyone to know, should he lose tonight, he will make history by having been nominated more times without losing than anyone else. So we want you to know, Scott, that we're all rooting for you. We hope you lose. And everyone cheered. So I lost for the seventh time, and just earlier this year I lost for the eighth time.
Oh, my.
For a story that in this collection, Liars, Fakers, and the Dead Who Eat Them. It was for
that,
a novelette
that,
called...
That's comma tragic there.
For, yes. But I believe
it reminds me of Molesberg one year. Barry Molesberg opened the Cordwainer Smith Awards, which are given out at ReaderCon for writers who have been unjustly generally forgotten.
Yes. Yes.
Barry one year opened the ceremonies by saying, understand that if you are, this is bestowed upon you, it means that you have failed, that you've been forgotten. Nobody knows who the heck you are, even though you've done some incredibly hard work. But let's face it, when you get this, know that you are a failure. And there are all these people you could have heard a pin drop.
Well, that is Barry, about whom I regret not being able to get him an award, because the year Martha Sukup won a Nebula Award for her story, she was up against Barry Malzberg for a story I published. So they were opposite. I was at a table with the two of them, knowing that whatever happened, either they would both lose or one or the other would lose. Barry was also nominated for a Hugo Award for that story as well. I can't remember if he was nominated for other things, but alas, he did not.
Now, Barry, if you are listening, It's been way too
sleep,
long.
Yes.
No, he used to. Well, first of all, he has a problem with this. When I was on 5 to 7 a.m., he was very happy to drive in from Jersey and then drive home in the light of day. Mm-hmm. He doesn't care for these hours. And also, he's had foot trouble and stuff.
Yeah.
But now, in his case, I'd be willing to either A, drive to him, because I learned how to drive about 20 years ago, and B, you know, we could Skype.
I saw a couple of couches here in the studio. I'm sure you could just put them up after the episode is over and have them wait for light to dawn.
We have couches. No,
I
don't.
Think so. Yeah. Maybe that was just a person who was asleep in a corner.
I think that was more likely.
Took them for a couch.
They were the people who we heard screaming.
The man who mistook his coworker for a couch. I think
that's exactly,
the next Oliver Sacks book.
Exactly. Yes. Now, you brought two things to read. I forgot what the timing on them
were. I bought two pieces. I bought a science fiction story, one of the ones that was an analog. Again, both of these are so long, they cannot be read in their entirety. I tend to write long. To me, flash fiction is 5,000 words, so both of these are around the 13 or 14,000 word length. So,
wow.
I've pulled about the first 13 minutes of the science fiction one and maybe the first 8 out of the horror zombie one.
Now, do you want to do both this morning, or shall we leave it as an excuse for you to come back?
You can leave it as an excuse to come back, which you can judge. Too bad we don't have people on Facebook saying, would they rather hear a horror science fiction?
Well, let's see.
Would they rather hear? They can vote. We have a story that appeared in Analog that would be a story called How Val Finally Escaped from the Basement.
And you're in there with Kenneth Schneier.
Yes, it's very nice. Or the beginning of it all depends, of course, whether people want to hear us yammer more than read, because this one will be about 5 more minutes than the...
Don't hit the table. You've got a mic on it. I think yammering is good, because that would give us more time for, yammering and phone
and
calls.
And blathering.
And stuff like that there. And, you know, we might want to take a musical break at some point.
Mm-hmm. I didn't bring my ukulele.
Oh.
Well, I thought there were rights issues, so I couldn't play anything.
We're usually covered on rights.
Oh, okay. So next time I'll bring the ukulele.
We pay ASCAP and BMI and Sound Exchange and all that. So, no, it's quite legal. It gets weird. We're allowed to broadcast it. We can stream it. But you can't legally download it. Mm. That's where it gets into trouble.
All right.
So it's let's not go there, but that's the case. If there are people who have a strong feeling, zombie versus SF, and you are one of the... many, there's currently 6 people live on Facebook.
Yes.
We probably threw a lot off when we went through the Wi-Fi debacle. Mm. Let us know. Just type a Z or an SF. Okay, Heather would like to hear the Analog story.
All right.
Okay, well, that's one vote. Let's get at least
two
or three. Two,
okay, let's see.
And see if there's an overwhelming... Deb wants the SF, so that's two.
Particularly, I don't know which Heather that might be. If that happens to be my niece Heather, I don't know. Then I think her vote should win over.
It's now 3-0.
Oh, okay. 3-0.
3-0 for SF over zombies, as it were. There's another title. SF over zombies.
Yes.
Yeah. It would be a musical, I think. Well, why don't we take a musical break? Regardless.
What are we going to sing? Are we going to do something from Les Mis or start doing Hamilton?
What is
this musical break that you and I are going to perform?
I don't know. And we're actually getting a phone call. But the decision has been made, listeners, that we're going to do SF. But if we're going to do SF, that doesn't mean that the music that we're going to play has to stick to that theme.
Zombie Jamboree took place in a New York cemetery. It was a zombie jamboree, took place
place in a New York cemetery. Zombies from all part of the island. Some of them was great Calypsonians. Since the season was carnival, they get together in Bacchanal and they singing back to back, belly to belly. Don't give a damn, I done that already.
Oh no.
Back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. You hear me talking, back to back, belly to belly. Don't give a damn, I done that already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. One female zombie wouldn't behave. See how she jumping out of the grave. In one hand she holding rum, with the other hand she knocking conga drum. The lead singer start to make his rhyme, while the other zombies rattling in time. One bystander had this to say, it was a trick to see the zombies break away. And they singing back to back, belly to belly. Don't give a damn, done there already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. Hey, you talking, back to back, belly to belly. Don't give a damn, I've done there already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. Now I must speak to Miss Bridget Bardot and say, Miss Bardot, take it slow. Cause all the men think they're Casanova when they see that she's barefoot all over. Even old men out in Topeka find their hearts are getting weaker and weaker. So we must ask her, for your sake and mine, at least wear her earrings part of the time. And we're singing back to back, belly to belly. Don't give a damn, done there already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. Once again now, back to back, belly to belly. Don't give a damn, done there already. Back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. Now they beating war drums in the Congo, and the beatniks are beating the bongo. So it's up to us, you and me, to put an end to this catastrophe. We must appeal to their goodness of heart, to pitch in and all do their part. Cause if this atomic war begin, they won't even have a part to pitch in. And we'll be singing back to back, belly to belly. Don't give a damn, done there already. Back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. Hey, you're talking back to back, belly to belly, don't give a damn, done there already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. A little softer. I'm back to your grace now. Now cover up with the dirt. Hey, that one there, your foot sticking out, cover up.
Harry Belafonte. The Kingston Trio also do a version of Zombie Jamboree. I'm always astonished. I grew up listening to Harry Belafonte and Kingston Trio and things like that. And I'm always astonished at how few people actually know that song. But it's a wonderful little, best zombie song I know.
Well, the Kingston Trio song I do on the ukulele is Charlie on the MTA.
Of course.
That's the one I
But will he ever return?
Yes. But there's no ukulele, so singing it would not do.
Yeah. My problem with most of the Kingston Trio albums and songs, and why I chose Harry Belafonte over the Kingston Trio this time, well, first of all, because it was Harry Belafonte, and secondly, because the Kingston Trio usually spend as much or more time than the Smothers Brothers in setting up a song, you know, just talking. MTA, they do a whole Huntley Brinkley report. Yes. And fewer people will understand that than the problem that no longer exists with the MTA, where you pay by the used to pay by the distance you traveled.
Yes. Well, also, they were raising the rate. Yes. Fight the fare increase. That's the final verse. You
know? Yes. Yes, it is.
Vote for, I can't remember who it is anymore.
Okay. Now, how about I Was a Teenage Zombie by The Flesh? I can't read the last word. It's not because you didn't type it well, Joel. It is because the thing that holds the camera, my little stand-in, blocks a portion
of
the
So obviously
the
someone
screen.
Else needs to make a comment and make his comment rise up outside of that.
That's it, rise from the dead. Yeah, exactly. If it does, there we go. This is, by the way, people should be told, WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, webcasting over WBAI.org, and video casting over Facebook Live on Jim Freund's timeline. The Flesh Tones is what Joel says was the name of the group. I've actually heard of them. So you were going to read... I should say, again, this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Somebody wants to know, where are you from, Scott? I don't think they're saying, where are you from, Scott? I think they're saying, where are you from?
Originally Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I've lived all
He's
over
home.
The place. Yeah, this is not... Right here. I did not grow up on Atlantic Avenue, but I lived in Brownsville, Canarsie, Georgetown, Crown Heights, Bay Ridge, Bensonhurst, Ocean Parkway.
I've lived in one of those.
There are probably a few more neighborhoods that I'm forgetting. Did I say Canarsie? I can't remember.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, but I, you know, 8 or 9 of them, and then ended up living in Massachusetts for a while, ended up living in Maryland for a while, and currently I'm in the wilds of West Virginia.
And literally the wilds.
On 8 acres, yes, the middle of nowhere.
Ooh, that's nice.
Yeah, thanks to the internet. Without the internet, it wouldn't be possible. Just think, I spent 13 years working for the Sci-Fi Channel, editing their websites from being in West Virginia. Not that science fiction. I was always living in the science fiction future because it wouldn't have been possible. I would have had to live and work in Manhattan. That's what freed me from living there.
Yeah.
You know, people say, oh, do you get lonely out there in the middle of West Virginia? And you're saying, lonely? I can't get rid of all you people. Combine Twitter, Facebook, and all that. There's no Instagram. I can't lose people. So there is no being alone anymore. There is, and I, you know, go to all those conventions. You know, there's always a convention either the month behind or the month ahead. So I'm never away from people for very long.
Yeah, there was a fellow from Baltimore by the name of Mark Owings, who you may recall mm-hmm. from years past. And he used to say, there are about 50 to 60 science fiction conventions a year in this country. Doesn't it do your heart good to know that you can't be at all of them? Mm-hmm. Although, as mentioned earlier, you did two at once. Well, one
yes.
was a science fiction convention, the other was Comic-Con.
Yes, yes.
Which I always... slightly turn up a nose at.
Well, it is a difficult thing to talk. Just my first convention, I was 15 years old. It took place in the Statler Hilton Hotel, which means every time I come out of Penn Station and see the Hotel Pennsylvania, I'm on the site of my first convention that I went to at age 15. In the program book at the time, there were 238 pre-registered members.
Yeah.
All of our names are there.
That would have been a Lunacon.
Yeah. Well, no, it was a Phil Suling 4th of July.
Oh, one of those. Okay, yes.
4th of July. No, Lunacon was my first science fiction convention. I went to one in 1970.
Because those were many of those were at the Statler
Hilton.
Yeah,
so I was in the Statler Hilton Hotel for many different conventions. The Star Trek convention was that I was at, was in that hotel.
The first Star Trek convention in the world was there.
Yeah, yeah. And I was at that. So
and the second was at the Commode.
Run by
the
Lunarians, you know, from Lunacon. From a comic book convention that had 300 or 400 people at it, and when I stopped going to comic book conventions, maybe they had 2,000 people, and then to return, and there was 150,000 people.
But as the comic book conventions evolved, they became less about comics.
That is true.
And more about the franchises that the comics...
It is difficult, but if you know where to look, you can find it. After all, if you there are a sufficient number of dealers at the San Diego Comic-Con selling comics that still occupies a larger square footage than those early comic book-only conventions. It's just they're hidden on the fringes. You know, the center is all filled of giant Pikachus and all at Warner Brothers building a giant water tower like they have on the TV shows and so on. So, It's still there. It's just you have to go to the outer fringes of this gigantic convention hall. And one year when I was working for the Sci-Fi Channel, I decided I would put up on YouTube a video of walking the full length of the convention hall. And I stood with my back on one end, and I walked very slowly, holding my flip cam, through the entire convention hall. It took me, I think, 16 minutes to make it from one end of the hall to the other, once you had all the aisles and streets. And that's not every aisle. That was just, if you think of something that is, you know, 25 or 30 streets and, you know, a dozen avenues, it's gigantic. And we have one in well, New York Comic Con as well.
Which is pretty large
as San Diego.
No, but it's it fills up the Javits Center.
But I do feel sad for the kids because I was walking around. It's almost like Times Square on New Year's Eve. And I thought, if you are 8 years old, all you're seeing are the belt buckles of the adults who were there. You're not actually seeing as you're taking those little tiny steps.
Which is probably a good thing, because on the heads of the same adults, they're wearing the most ridiculous things.
But if you do get out to those fringes where the comic book stuff is, it is less travel. That's the thing. And that's where I always go. Look at the old comics. Look at the original artwork. And it's fascinating to see the original artwork, because my job at Marvel Comics when I was hired was to proofread comic books. I would sit there with the original artwork and a blue pencil. And if there was a typo, or if the webbing under Spider-Man's arm was wrong or something like that, I would write a little note alongside it and send it off to a department to be fixed. Well, those notes are still there. So if I go and look at the artwork from 1974, 75, 76, and so on, that period, I might see my handwriting along the side of the original artwork that's being sold, saying,
cool.
No, Namor's belt buckle is wrong, or you forgot to put the wing on his outside ankle, or whatever.
Yeah, I had committed a horrible, horrible thing. I had two panels of pencils of Doctor Strange by Steve Ditko.
Yes, and what is the horrible thing that you have done?
I stored them very poorly downstairs in my house, and then eventually there was a flood.
Oh, that's a
shame. And the flood destroyed at least 1,000 books, maybe a few more. Ironically, my comic collection, which I do not cherish the way I do my book collection, survived.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have one large box of comics of largely Doctor Strange's from the Ditko era and the 60s. And for the most bizarre reason, people say, oh, yeah, Doctor Strange, sure. But, you know, until Benedict Cumberbatch, very few people had heard of Doctor Strange. WBAI had a radio serial of Doctor Strange that 15 minutes a week. And I used to listen to that on a regular basis. And for that reason, I collected those comics.
And I'm wondering, is that the character Bill Murray played? There was one of those Marvel radio shows. Google it. Bill Murray, I don't know if it was they did the Fantastic Four one, or they did one of the characters. They had those little 15-minute radio programs. I remember that Bill Murray
that would be from the early days.
That
would be from the National Lampoon Radio Hour. That's where that would have been done. Only thing that Bill Murray did associated with BAI was when Eric Idle filmed a piece of All You Need Is Cash, the Ruddles movie, for those who remember the Ruddles. And they used a studio at the church of WBAI. We used to own a building that was a deconsecrated church. And we had a lovely studio in there, edit room, actually. And Bill Murray sat in there and while the Ruddles were landing at Idlewild Airport. And he was Bill Murray the K, which was very clever. And I actually gave them a joke that they used, and they needed call letters for the fictional radio station. And I said, how about WCWC Flushing? And Bill Murray didn't get it, but Eric Idle explained it, and they used it.
And I will point out, thanks to the miracle of the internet, Bill Murray was in a Marvel Comics radio show having nothing to do with WBAI. He played the Human Torch in 1975, and supposedly there are a dozen episodes available online.
Oh, my duck, really?
In 1975, at the same time they were doing the National Lampoon Radio Hour. So it was before he was on Saturday Night Live. Yes, you can listen to the 10 episodes. If you Google Bill Murray, Human Torch. So it had nothing to do with the Doctor Strange. But yeah, that's a little bit of trivia early on in his career.
No, Bill Murray was not in Doctor Strange.
No. So, Fantastic Four radio.
Yeah,
radio.
I'll tell you who was in most of the WBAI radio dramas of that era. John Lithgow.
Oh.
Who was actually our arts director for a while. I was his intern. And I performed with Lithgow on stage because when people say, hey, we've got John Lithgow here, I'm the first person they think. No, actually, we did the Pooh Players.
And did you get a Tony for that?
No, I got one for something else, a story I will not tell on the air. But yes, it's true. I have I have approximately 1/8, either 1/6 or 1/8 of a Tony Award for Best Play.
Now, when you say you won't tell it on air, you can't tell
No, I won't.
Okay.
I won't. I don't care to share that
story. Because you are a very humble individual. We all say that.
Because it was controversial.
Oh, okay. Right.
And we'll just leave it at
Let us leave it at that.
Let us leave it at that. So I don't like to name the play. I don't like to go into it. I was fired from the show before it went to Broadway.
Oh, my goodness.
But I was still, at one point, a producer of record of the show. So when it won the Tony Award, I owned a piece of that. Mm-hmm. So actually, story I've never told on the air.
Oh.
One of many.
Well, now you've made people curious.
So I hope not.
You could get lots of drinks at the bar when people would come up and offer to buy you a drink, saying, tell me that.
I allude to it on my Wikipedia page.
Okay.
It says where I've produced theater, sometimes to shockingly successful effect.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I can tell you very briefly when we're done. But would you like to read at this point?
If you would like me to.
I would love
you to. I don't
know
how much time we have for this as opposed to...
Well, how long...
This is about 13 minutes to end of the suitable
then
place.
Then it's a perfectly...
You think it's a good length?
Yes, I do.
All right. This is a story called How Val Finally Escaped from the Basement. It appeared in the November-December 2017 issue of Analog, the magazine...
Raise it up
the
a
magazine
there
which
we
it
go.
Took me... 44 years to sell a story, but this is not that story. This is the second story that I sold about 4 months later.
It'll be even cooler when you get a story on the cover.
Yes, someday.
Yeah, and I will say in advance, please excuse me while you read that story.
You're going to take a nap?
I'm going to leave
the
room.
I hope the snoring will not
interfere with
you.
I'm
going to
leave the room.
But you'll keep an eye on the clock, so
I'll be hearing every word. We do have monitors around the station, not to mention the fact that there's no soundproofing. I don't need monitors.
That's
I can
right.
hear you from down the hall.
All right.
But I'm just going to check my mail and do a couple of minor things like
Go
that.
Go for it. Well, I will then read the opening few scenes of How Val Finally Escaped from the Basement. Val liked working nights at the Flaketown Dash Mart, especially those shifts that sent him to the children's department way in the rear of the store. Few customers ever made it back there that late, so as he put the finishing touches on a crib he'd been assembling under the fluorescent lights, the solitude filled him with a sense of peace. He was alone there. He felt safe. He could breathe. And then he couldn't. Everything changed shortly after he unboxed a mobile, meant until later when it would dangle over a newborn, to catch the eyes of shoppers as it rotated near the crib's wooden headboard. Instead, unexpectedly, the mobile caught his eyes, and then he found himself suddenly holding it much too tight. Rocket ships and robots dangled around a central planet he couldn't recognize and didn't want to try. All he assumed were modeled after a recent blockbuster science fiction movie, a movie he imagined he might once have liked had only he seen it years before, but which now he'd never willingly watch. Just one of the many things his uncle's death and all that came after had stolen from him. He'd been about to hook the mobile to the crib and flick the switch that would start the music playing and the cheap plastic miniatures spinning when he hesitated, as it all suddenly became too much. It was only when he noticed the rocket ships dancing at the ends of their strings that he realized he was trembling and was then startled to discover he needed to fight back tears. Damn rocket ships. If he never saw another rocket ship, never heard anyone speak of them, of outer space, of aliens again, that would be just fine with him. Damn those who'd come to in those tin cans for what they'd given, damn them for what they'd taken away. He closed his eyes and pinched the bridge of his nose to stop from crying. It would destroy all he'd been working for to be found that way after he'd been doing so well at his new job, even with the sketchy past he'd had to fabricate for his employer, and he didn't want to be forced to move on with a new look and a new name yet again so soon, and when he opened his eyes once more, a man was staring at him. A man, alone, in the children's department, a place where mostly only couples or perhaps a lone woman would wander, and that during the day. Seeing him there at night, when that section was usually deserted, made Val even more uncomfortable. The man was bearded and appeared haunted, with a gaze that made it seem as if he was looking less at what was in front of him than at things a million miles away. But then Val suspected he would also have appeared pretty much the same to anyone who happened to glance in his direction. For Val, the haunted look had come first. The beard, a necessary disguise, followed later. Sometimes that beard helped with what he was trying to do, sometimes it didn't. He returned to tinkering with the crib less because he still needed to attach the mobile to complete his task than because he wanted to turn his back at that moment on the man's unwanted stare. Too many people had looked at him for too long. Looked, and worse. But maybe he'd be lucky this time. Maybe the man was a confused customer and nothing more than... "You," came a voice from behind as Val felt a hand on his elbow. "You're him. You are, aren't you? You're the nephew." Val turned slowly, looked in the man's eyes, and recognized there that expression which told him he'd been recognized. He threw the mobile at the man, who didn't bother to try to catch it, and then ran. He didn't get far. Val could hear his name being shouted, not the one by which his co-workers at Dashmart had come to know him, but his true name, the one he'd abandoned many jobs, many cities, seemingly many lifetimes ago in order to survive. He ignored the call, but couldn't ignore the stinging in his back as darts pierced his shirt and embedded in his skin, couldn't ignore the surge of electricity that followed. He convulsed against a tower of infant formula and fell first onto linoleum and then into unconsciousness. Val awoke to find himself tied to a chair, his ankles bound by duct tape to its legs, his chest bound against its back, and as best as he could tell, he was in a windowless room of a type far too familiar to him. The cinderblock walls of what surely, damnably, had to be a basement were obscured for the most part by industrial shelving loaded with random clutter that gave him no clue as to either the owner or his location, and stacked in the gaps bare of shelving was a random assortment of liquor boxes, dented suitcases, and yellowing newspapers. Above him, a bare light bulb buzzed. Propped against a metal folding chair opposite him was a poster-sized slice of corrugated cardboard on which had been mounted a large photograph of an elderly man who had tubes running from his nose. Yet even with those tubes and the obvious pain on his face, the man still managed to smile at whoever had been on the opposite side of the camera. Val had no idea who this subject was exactly, but he felt he could be fairly certain of his relationship to the man who had captured him. He was his father, Val imagined. He appeared too old to be his captor's brother, and would anyone have bothered capturing him like this for just an uncle? Probably not. Well, Val wouldn't have, anyway. He craned his neck in an attempt to learn whether the rest of the room behind him was as dismal as what was in front of him. When he failed in that, he tried to twist his chair around, but could not, for it had been bolted to the floor. His abduction had not been spontaneous. Someone had been planning this. "I know what you're thinking," came a voice from the unseen section of the room. His captor stepped into view, smiling. He no longer looked quite so haunted. "And yes, you are. You're in a basement." That wasn't what I was thinking. Wasn't your uncle's basement anything like this one? Was your uncle's basement anything like this one? No, said Val, it was nothing like this. Nothing in the world could ever be anything like that basement. And I'm nothing like my uncle. You know that, don't you? Though maybe I... Val refused to let himself finish the thought. Yet you don't seem surprised to be here. Why would I be? I knew I'd end up here eventually. Well, not exactly here, but some other place like here. A person can only run so fast and so far. Val tilted his head forward toward the sickly man's image, one not so unlike hundreds of others he had thrust towards him before he vanished. And that is, he was my father, said the man, stepping up beside the photograph. And your uncle killed him. My uncle may have been foolish. My uncle may have let a lot of people down, only the whole planet, but he didn't kill anybody. Keep telling yourself that, the man said, pointing angrily at Val, then taking a deep breath and slowly letting his hand drop. Your uncle was a bad, bad man, and if you can't see that, you're a bad, bad man, too. Maybe I am, Val said wearily, but not for the reasons you think. Some things are much worse than anything my uncle ever did. Val nodded at the photograph once more. Nothing you could possibly do to me is going to bring him back, he said. Surely you know. The world has changed, but it hasn't changed that much. I know, answered the man. But seeing you trapped down here, knowing I've got you the same year your uncle had that thing locked away, that's going to make me feel a whole lot better about it. How many years did your uncle keep it hidden? No one really knows for sure. Well, I guess it doesn't really matter, said the man, vanishing again behind Val, who could hear rising footsteps as the voice trailed off. You'll be down here even longer. So get used to looking at my father's face. You'll be seeing a whole lot of it during the months ahead. It had been several years since Val had last heard from his Uncle Tommy, or made any attempt to reach out on his own, which was wrong, he knew, yet knowing that had never motivated him to change, when the call came from the lawyer. At first, not recognizing the number, Val wasn't going to answer, but then the area code tickled his memory, and he had a sick feeling he'd better pick up. It turned out to be a lawyer whose name he vaguely recalled from when his father had died, and after she verified it really was Val she was talking to, the woman informed him that his uncle, who had passed this time, he was the only surviving heir, and how did he wish to proceed? Val and his uncle had never been close, and he'd always felt somewhat guilty about that, more guilty than he felt about having turned his back on most of his family. His father's brother deserved a better nephew, and Val was not, and never had been, that. On learning of Uncle Tommy's death, Val was surprised to discover that what rose up inside wasn't more of that same guilt. Instead, it was the uncomfortable self-awareness, which had previously risen up many times over the years, that he wasn't only not such a good nephew, he wasn't even as good a person as he liked to pretend himself to be. The guilt, when it came, and it would come, would only arrive later, once he got the thick envelope of paperwork and learned Uncle Tommy still owned that house, and the house was now his, and he found himself thinking more about the windfall he'd pocket from its sale than the loss of what to most other people would have been a close relative. But that guilt was small compared to the guilt he'd feel later once he actually got inside, once he made it into the basement. He took a week off from work. No problem for him, considering all the unused vacation time he'd accumulated, which had even gotten to be a joke around the office, and drove to the lawyer's, where he picked up the keys, accompanied by condolences Val accepted grimly. It turned out, he learned, that the words, "Sorry for your loss," fall quite uncomfortably on the ears when one doesn't feel that much of a loss at all. He planned to give the house a cursory inspection, quickly see how little he could get away with in the way of repairs, what was the least that was needed to be done to get the place in shape for a quick sale, and then go back to his apartment and back to his life such as it was. And he knew, since he was being honest with himself, that if he thought of his uncle at all from then on, it would be to tamp down the accompanying shame that he'd let the man die alone. And he'd do a good job of it, too. The small house in the suburbs that Uncle Tommy had occupied alone ever since he'd inherited it after his parents had died and left it to him was in much better shape than Val had expected. He thought he'd entered to find evidence of years of hoarding, with narrow mazes winding through piles of junk. Isn't that what eventually happens to all bachelors when they don't have friends or relatives checking up on them and pushing them to do better? But instead, the rooms were neat and clean, with no sense that there lived a loner. It was so orderly it made Val feel a bit embarrassed about the state of his own apartment. In fact, its starkness surprised him, for as he walked through the house, devoid of clutter, devoid even of personality, he got no sense of who his uncle was. No family photos on the walls hinted at a shared family history. No souvenirs gave evidence of trips taken. No shelving filled with well-thumbed books. There wasn't a sense of, well, Tommy-ness, not a single clue as to the life he'd lived. But Val shouldn't have needed any clues to form a picture of his uncle. He should have known. He and Uncle Tommy had never been close, and as he wandered a house which seemed as if it had been already ready for sale, though the lawyer assured Val he discovered nothing had been touched, everything was just as they found it after the neighbors had called the police had found the lawyer's number, he no longer remembered why, and it seemed like a thing he should remember. There was so little to see up on the ground level that he got to the basement sooner than he expected, and as it turned out, sooner than he would have liked. Once more, there was no obvious signs of who the man had been. The metal shelves that lined the cinder block walls were filled with random assortment of tools, a couple of lamps, and a few illegibly labeled dusty boxes that on first glance yielded no immediate information. He could have been in the center of anybody's basement. As he scanned the shelves, searching for something, anything that could have belonged to more than just a random stranger, an artifact or two that would tell him who Uncle Tommy had been, he spotted, barely visible between two boxes, the corner edges of a large piece of wood mounted to the wall. Only after he'd moved those boxes aside could he tell that what he'd revealed was the covering of an opening to the house's crawl space, and in addition to the edges of the wood screwed into the wall, a long vertical board held it in place, the board affixed with a hinge on the top end and a hole in the bottom that settled over a metal loop, and through the protruding loop a lock. What could Uncle Tommy have owned valuable enough to lock away? None of the keys given to Val by the lawyer fit, so he rummaged through the tools in search of a crowbar. He couldn't find one there, though he did set aside a screwdriver, but upstairs in the garage he came across a sturdy shovel which seemed as if it would be strong enough to serve. He returned to the basement and moved the rest of the boxes out of his way, then jammed the lip of the shovel under the board near the hinge and put his weight against the handle until the screws wrenched out of the wood. As he did so, watching the board rock like a pendulum from the broken lock, it occurred to him anyone could have done what he just did, so perhaps the safeguards Uncle Tommy had built weren't really intended to keep anyone out. Val unscrewed the corners of the board, which then dropped to the cement floor, exposing the rectangular opening of the crawl space. He squinted into the darkness, looking for the sort of thing he imagined might have been worth hiding there. A strong box, perhaps, or maybe coffee cans. It could have been stuffed with cash, anything, to hint his uncle had earned something worth protecting over the years. He'd heard of old people doing that, losing faith in banks and hiding cash that was often never found until years after it had rotted. But as he stared into the space, which extended far deeper than he would have expected, he could make out nothing. He tilted his head slightly to allow more light to enter from the bare basement bulb. For a moment, he thought he could see light glinting off the metallic grillwork of a window screen. But who would bother storing window screens in there, and what screens would be circular? And that's when Val first found himself looking into the eyes of the creature from another world. And we shall stop there. And to find out what's really going on and how Val finally escaped from the basement, you would have to pick up, as is the title, the November-December 2017 issue of Analog. That was only about the first quarter, perhaps, of the story.
But it's a nice start.
Thank you.
I must say.
I know. When I read it at conventions and stop right there, people are upset with me. I do try to stop at the point where people go, no, you can't stop then.
Yeah. But no, as you know, at many conventions, I teach a reading aloud for the public kind of thing, particularly for writers. And in telling them what to choose, if you can't do a self-contained work, which is better, find, don't just like trail off and say, well, if you want to find out what happens.
You need a cliffhanger. I mean, you want the audience to feel cheated. It's always leave them wanting more. That's
yeah,
the line.
That's the deal.
And there are several stories.
Or give them satisfaction. That's the
yes.
Other
oh,
side.
If you have a short piece that you're able to squeeze in. But
yeah,
we did not want to use 45 to 50 minutes or whatever to tell the entire story.
Well, it depends. But you see, had you been on the show before, We could have and would have. Mm-hmm. No problem with that. As I wrote you,
yes.
We have gone lengths much longer.
Well, next time.
That.
Well, it took 30 years to get me here. So what year is this? So in 2048, when you celebrate your, 81st year at WBAI, then we shall do it again.
Yeah, something like that would be, yeah. I'm approaching my 51st be my 51st anniversary.
Yes.
So it'll be my 52nd year.
Yes.
Here.
Congratulations.
And since I started, and another way to figure all this out is since I first volunteered here in 1967, that means, like they say in baseball, 60s, 70s, mm-hmm. 80s, 90s, aughts, and teens, I'm in my sixth decade of working here. In 2 years, I'll be a seven-decade member.
Now, are you counting all those years you spent as an intern for Marconi when the radio was being invented and you were a small child?
Well, I was not working for Marconi directly. I basically told Tesla what to do at that time.
Good.
And he was the one working for Marconi. Yeah.
Yes.
But yes, indeed. Do you want to take a chance on calls?
If someone is awake, willing to call.
Yeah, now, you see, you say that. Now, I have listeners all over the world.
Yes, and maybe some friends in California are listening.
And maybe
California.
They are, you know, in which case it's...
Or people are calling from
the UK. Still yesterday.
Yes, well, see if a call comes in, and I guess then I'll need a headphone.
Let me give the phone number. It is, although I mentioned we only have one phone line, and it's already ringing, and I suspect I know who that is.
How do they know the phone number?
Well, they remember because they write it down. They want to call in. But you see, we have a completely absurd phone number. It's not like
whatever it is, they'll call it now.
Yeah.
Whoever owns that phone number.
Okay, 555-4000.
Yes.
Okay, it's always 555. That's
yes,
not a
that's
real
right.
exchange. So, you know, 555-4000 or anything like that. Our number here is 347-335-0818. Now, how can anybody remember that? There's no rhythm to that number whatsoever. No. And I have been here through many, many, many phone numbers through the years, both pledge lines and on-the-air numbers. And this is the least usable.
Well, you have to write a song about it.
Well,
then people will sing
we had a song
to the number
written by Frank Heller that we had on a cart so that it was a bouncy little number too.
But it doesn't exist. Was the cart in your basement?
No, actually, it was. Along with some really wonderful carts, including one by Lithgow called Mr. Rouet's Neighborhood, which was a very bizarre Fred Rogers kind of a thing. But, or not Fred Rogers, it was might be a compared to. And if Fred Rogers had serious problems, I think, as only the dementia of John Lithgow could come up with.
Okay.
He's got a one-man show coming up with on Broadway where I'm sure he's going to be doing material like that. Mm. But, Heller sent me a 6-CD set of all of this music with his own artwork from National... Ah. Well, and he did artwork for Nat Lamp.
Hmm.
More importantly, he did. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he did artwork. Now, don't laugh for the National Lampoon Radio Hour because they did. They had ads. They had things going out, and they had album covers.
You know, and that actually should be their ad. The National Lampoon Radio Hour. Don't laugh. So you've just said.
Well, actually, There were any number of albums in which they did.
Didn't laugh.
My favorite one was they had an album of stereophonic testing sounds. You know, so they would have a bit saying, okay, this is a sound that is sure to make your speakers sound bad. So beware and get ready. Your speakers don't want to hear this sound. And they would start playing it, and then you heard John Belushi screaming at the top of his lungs, "Stop it! Stop it! Whatever you do, stop it!" That one had me in stitches. Yeah. That one was brilliant. And Bill Murray worked a lot on those as well. Because
you can't live on the Human Torch money.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I don't think people could live on that Nat Lamp money either. I've given out the phone number. You will need to wear your headphones
There are two sets of headphones. The one closest to me?
I think so. Let me know if you're getting enough volume on them. Because if not, I
don't think I'm hearing anything.
Okay, let me see.
Do I have the wrong?
I don't know. How about now? Are they any better?
I'm not hearing a thing.
Those are my headphones. Okay.
Shall I try the other set?
Well, you know what? They are. See where they are attached?
Yes.
See where they're plugged in? There should be a dial. And that dial probably controls the volume.
Yeah.
On that little box there.
Yes. Now do you have to speak for me?
Okay, 1, 2,
oh,
1, 2.
I'm hearing you now.
Ah, there you go.
Do I want to hear? I'll turn it down again.
Yeah, you don't want to hear me. Okay, so now that we've settled that little problem, good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning.
Hi there.
Yes. Well, thank you, James, for playing the good Mr. Belafonte. I sort of figured you would go in that direction. Thank you.
Talk to Scott.
Yes. Mr. Edelman, good morning.
Good morning.
I must say, you would have made a perfect writer-creator for cliffhanger serials of the classic 30s and 40s. By the way, thank you to Turner Classics. It actually is now showing one on Saturday morning, thank God. But in any case, I will have to run out when I get back from the UK, and by that November-December issue,
November,
you said?
November-December 2017, yes. My second, I have analog stories in the first issue of the year and the last, so the January-February issue, and this is the November-December
So it's issue. Easy to remember.
Yes. Now, you mentioned that, that you are a regular attendee of Balticon, therefore I'm assuming you know Baltimore. And I also assume that
who attend conventions don't know the cities where the cons are because they don't leave the hotel
Except for food. Well, I was going to get to the food. Since you are a food connoisseur, have you ever eaten at an establishment called Bertha's?
I don't believe I have. Bertha's, is that a...
It's a seafood place.
No, I don't believe I've been to that one.
It is so renowned. It's noted for their mussels, and there is even a song about it called
Okay, I know. I've seen the bumper stickers. I've seen the T-shirts. I have not made it to that one. I've eaten at many places around Baltimore and outside of Baltimore as well. I like going to Chaps Pit Beef. I like... Diablo Donuts is my favorite donut place
I love
around
Diablo
there.
Donuts, yes. So, now, let me ask you. You say that you are working for the Skiffy Channel, or you have worked for them?
I have. I worked there for 13 years, and in 2000...
There's no C in Skiffy anymore.
Yes, now it's S-Y-F-Y, yes.
Yes.
I call it the Syphilis Channel.
Yes, I started working for them in 2000, and I was not responsible for anything on the air, so do not blame me for the fact that a show was canceled during that period of time.
Nor were you responsible for the canceling of the sci-fiction.
No, not that either.
I'm just wondering whether you even follow any of their current programming. I'm curious to know if you've seen any of this new Krypton series.
I have not watched it yet. I am... here's a little secret about me that people who follow me on Facebook know. I am struggling. In order to get writing done, I only watch an hour of television a day, and I watch that on the treadmill. So right now I am currently...
So the show keeps spinning around and around and around. So, very difficult to keep track.
So I am behind on things. I am currently watching a show called Runaways, which is another Marvel, let's say Marvel comic book show as opposed to a DC show. I am very interested in seeing Krypton, almost not as much for the Superman or Kryptonian aspects, but I've heard that Adam Strange has made an appearance on there as
a
character.
Yes, he has.
And I am a fan of the Adam Strange... shows do, they alter them in a way, but I do want to see what they've done to the Adam Strange, who, now is the actor playing that a former Doctor Who companion from 1 year? Is that, or am I thinking of a different character?
I could not tell you that. Last question.
Yes.
Since you are a Marvel expert, are you looking forward to Infinity War?
Oh, I am desperately looking forward to Infinity War, which I should perhaps be tossing off this show and have gone to see it, because I guess some of the screenings for the normal public were beginning tonight, I think. Very much so. But what I am most looking forward to, and I don't think I discussed this already, when it's 1 to 3 in the morning, you forget what you've mentioned and what you haven't mentioned. I already mentioned earlier in the show, yes, a character I co-created with Al Milgram will be in the Captain Marvel movie appearing next
March. Dr. Minerva?
Yes. Captain Marvel number 50. So that's the first time anything of mine is in the movies. And I understand, though I don't know and I haven't seen it, no spoilers, that Captain Marvel herself makes an appearance somewhere within the
Infinity
War
movie. Well, it's known
movie.
Because there was a cameo, there was a poster.
Yes.
And you could see a part of her
yes.
uniform.
So I very much look forward to that. But I get such a thrill when I go to those Marvel
this
movies.
This, I believe, is the movie with the coming of Thanos, is it not?
Yes, it is. And I also...
Well, he's been in most of the movies, but this one is him killing off all the characters.
And I...
Now, there's the plot.
I wrote a Thanos story.
Don't laugh. It's true.
Every single comic book story that I wrote for Marvel Comics has been reprinted. No comic book stories I wrote for DC have been reprinted. I have no understanding of why people do not want to read those Welcome Back Cotter comic books I wrote at DC. But for some reason, they don't get reprinted. But one of the stories I wrote was a Thanos standalone adventure with Drax the Destroyer, which I believe is on sale right now in something called a one-shot called Marvel True Believers Thanos the Unstoppable number 1 or something like that. They just sent me copies and it reprints the first...
Well, the timing is right.
Yeah. What it reprints is the first story by Jim Starlin and Mike Friedrich, which was in Iron Man, and it reprints the 6-page backup that I wrote of a standalone adventure with Thanos and Drax the Destroyer.
What were your thoughts on Black Panther and Ragnarok?
Oh, I love them. Well, they're two totally different movies, but
yeah,
I love them both.
Yeah, yeah.
It is extremely difficult for me. I am an extremely biased watcher of these movies.
Our guest next week.
Well, when I was a kid, I can remember having only 12 cents in my pocket, and I could only buy one comic book.
Yeah.
And there I was in Brooklyn on Avenue P at Joe and Morty's Candy Shop, looking at X-Men number 1 and Avengers number 1, and looking back again to X-Men number 1 and Avengers number 1, and only having 12 cents in my pocket and only being able to buy one. And you...
Which did you go for?
Well, I ended up going with the Avengers because they're all characters I knew. Who are these X people? I eventually did get that X-Men number 1. But when you are that age and Stan Lee is whispering into your ear... You look at these things and it's yourself at 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and 10 watching them and who you are now. So I could never give an opinion. So the joy I get seeing those characters on the screen is the joy of me as a little kid. So I love them both. I love seeing those characters on the screen. I love seeing even staying through the credits and looking at the end of Black Panther.
Well, one has to do that for all. I would do that, Marvel movie or not. I am a credits watcher, and I have been known to scream at people trying to clean a movie theater by turning on not just the house lights, but the floodlights during the credits of a movie.
Yeah. Well, when I look at those names and they go by and I see, oh, look, there's Don McGregor, who I worked with in the bullpen, who Chris Claremont, next week's guest, worked in the bullpen. There's You know, there's, you know, Bill Mantlow, who created Rock a Raccoon, and there's his name on the screen. There's Billy Graham, not the evangelist, but the artist who drew Luke Cage, you know, seeing his name on the screen. So I feel
think of all those characters.
But most of those people, the people who actually came out of the bullpen, they generally don't get credits in the movies.
They get credit if they influenced a particular... You don't get it at the beginning. At the Stan,
no,
and Jack, and Steve get it.
Chris
at the
Claremont
beginning.
Has yet to have a credit in anything except Legion. That's it.
Yeah. I think of all those
That's
characters.
It. He has appeared in several of the movies. He doesn't have credit. And he created many of the characters. As he told me, as I said earlier, there's, with the exception of Black Panther, there's not been a Marvel movie out in which he did not at least write, if not create, some of the characters. And when you're talking X-Men, he created many of those characters. And if he didn't create them, he wrote their backstories that everybody's familiar with now.
I think of all those Guardian characters, Mr. Edelman, that you mentioned. I think my favorite is Gamora.
I like her a lot.
I have bad news for you. But anyway.
Wait a second. No spoilers here, sir. Yes.
Well, it's this guy named Sodom.
Oh, okay.
And anyway.
Anyway, James, happy Beltane. I will think of you while I'm in Padstow next Tuesday.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Telephone number here at WBAI to speak with Scott Edelman is, you see, it's not even a 212 number. Or a 718 number. We're in Brooklyn. 347-335-0818. Or, okay, now let's see. Joel. Yeah, we're getting a lot of comments on the Facebook feed, particularly from Joel. Was there ever an attempt to preserve the original something published sci fiction after it was taken off line? And the answer is no, there was not. I can tell you, however, that if you go to the Internet Archive, to the Wayback Machine, you can see all the issues there, including the interview chats that I did with writers for Ellen Datlow, where I did those for her, and for Omni Online. And somebody says, the X-Men didn't seem... like all the, I'm sorry, I have to move the camera, the Super Kids early science fiction, ? I'm not sure I understand. And the Bill Graham, who was the protagonist of Sinister Barrier by Eric Frank Russell.
Oh, well, that was different. There was Billy Graham. Actually, there was a major article about him in the New York Times that I believe Sean Howe, the author of Marvel, The Untold Story, wrote about Billy Graham. He was one of the first African-American cartoonists to draw an African-American character on Luke Cage. But he did far much more than that. He was also an actor, director, producer. So he has his whole entire life. And Sean did this wonderful article unearthing all these things that I didn't know about when I would be working in the bullpen and he'd be bringing stories in. But he was a wonderful artist and did a lot of work with the writer Don McGregor on Black Panther, so he got a credit in the movie as well. But anyway, so it was just wonderful being among those people.
And there are two X-Men TV shows, one of which was pretty good and the other of which is incredibly brilliant. And the one that's pretty good is The Gifted, and which I didn't even know about till Chris told me about it 3 weeks ago. I didn't realize it existed. And that very much exists in the X-Men movie universe. It ties in perfectly well, except that for some reason the X-Men have left Earth and left The Gifted behind. But it's definitely, you know, you get similar characters and crossovers and all that. But I dare say that Legion may be conceivably the best television show currently running.
I have heard many good things about it, so that will have to add to the list.
Yeah. But warning, you have to watch it serially. Mm-hmm. You must watch from episode one, season one, through...
Oh, I understand. It's very surreal. So.
Oh, Yes. It makes Twin Peaks look normal times. I mean, it is extremely surreal. And the writing is brilliant. Mm. The characters are brilliant. But people are saying, well, it's style over substance. No, you just have to really, really pay attention. And at long last, the first thing you see when the episode is over says, created by Chris Claremont and Bill, help me.
Well, I don't know which Bill.
It was Polish Bill... last name artist.
Oh, Bill Sienkiewicz.
That's it.
Or Sienkiewicz.
Yeah, Bill Sienkiewicz. And that's, the, I mean, the show is Noah Hawley, which if you've watched the TV series Fargo. Okay, though this is the same person.
And Fargo, which is a more of a science fictional show than you might imagine.
Well, given the
second and third season.
Yeah, you know? I mean, given the flying saucer in the second one.
And the Hugo Award.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The character who goes out.
That's the third season, I believe.
Yes.
So it's a fascinating show.
Going to the Hugos, and it's such a dreary, humdrum little place.
Well, they came up with another name for it, but it was wonderful seeing all of the
But it's fake, an action.
Yeah, the old fake paperback book covers that this novel supposedly wrote as a Philip K. Dick-like character.
So yes.
People who are interested in science fiction who do not realize that there is, the second and third seasons do have some
direct tie-ins.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. But Legion is just, if you have never read anything X-Men, watched anything X-Men, didn't realize, you don't have to care. There's absolutely, there are a couple of oblique references that let you know when the big baddie, the Shadow King, tells the lead character, Danny, that your father defeated me in a battle. People are going, I know that's Charles Xavier's son. And otherwise you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
There's no...
It's an Easter egg.
It's a sidebar. The whole show is a sidebar, but it is brilliant. So all I'm saying is, if it had nothing to do with the X-Men, it would still be superb. I do believe, especially during the current season, that now maybe there is a better show that you know will come along later in the year. I'm talking about what's on right now.
Okay.
Of the various...
I shall head home when we are done.
Yes, and the cinematography is amazing. But give you an idea of the little jokes. One episode, in fact, episode before last, our lead character has to go into each person's mind to unlock their cotton mazes. Each one is in an inner maze. Our telepathic lead character goes into the mind of one and... It's trying to figure out what the key is, and we just see him and his companions, and we're talking Dan Stevens and Bill Irwin and Gene Smart, three brilliant actors under any circumstances. And they're very small characters at the bottom of the screen, and these big letters scroll atop of the top of the screen, and it says, "You are in a maze." And one of them says, "What should I do? Go left." And you realize they're playing Zork. I mean, that's what it is. And it's not, but if you don't know Zork, it still works.
Well, it has to.
Yeah, what? Don't trip over my deadly thing there, Lister.
We are running out of time.
I'm plugged in. We're... We have a minute and a half left.
Yeah. Take some more.
Let people know where they find you. Now, ScottEdelman.com. We should spell
Scott,
that.
ScottEdelmang. At almost 3 in the morning, I can still spell my own name.
Yeah.
And I'm on Twitter at the same Scott Edelman, ScottEdelman. I seem to live mostly on Twitter. I'm also on Instagram under the same name.
And you can
Facebook as well.
Yeah, and you can often be found posting videos of your readings.
on YouTube. I also, on YouTube, not only post my readings, but other people's readings.
Yes.
And sometimes full panels as well.
Yes. Which I'm very grateful for many of those.
Well, often what ends up happening at the podcast I do, eatingthefantastic.com, it has taken up a lot of my time because I will go to a convention and have 5 or 6 meals with people and record podcasts. Unlike with a regular podcast where you can lock yourself in a hotel room and do 10 episodes in a day if you have the energy, I'm going and taking you to a restaurant, sitting down. I can only eat so much over the course of a convention. So
yeah.
I've been doing more of that than videotaping panels. But if you would like to, you know, hear people, I just had an episode with Victor Laval, who wrote The Changeling, wonderful book, and many other
episodes. And I have to get him on the air. And he's a New Yorker, so this, you know.
I think he was given the key to Flushing somewhere in Queens. Someone gave him the key.
Yes, I heard that.
After one of his books happened. But anyway, that's where you can find me. I'm all over the place. If you want to hear more of my voice, eatingthefantastic.com, just download the episodes and I will haunt you forever.
Yeah, if you just use your favorite podcast aggregator.
Yes,
just
the RSS feed is there. If you just look at any episode, it will list what's
Well, if you use a good aggregator and you just type it in, it'll let you subscribe without looking for the RSS feed.
Okay.
Same is true for Hour of the Wolf, by the way.
Yes.
So speaking of which...
Speaking of a witch, where?
No.
Is a witch?
This show is founded by one, but in all seriousness. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. My guest has been Scott Edelman. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We will be back next week, not at 1 a.m., but at midnight. Midnight to 3 a.m., for the beginning, oh, God help us, of our next fun drive, our weekly, month-long fun drive. Every week, we have a month-long fun drive, because that's how WBAI tries to work. Thanks so much, Scott. This has been a long time.
Yes, and I will see you in 30 years.
Yeah, I'll see you earlier, and maybe we'll record something. So, again, thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper. Listeners already dressed for the show. And we will, and everybody be good to each other. Have a good morning. Thank you.
you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the bitch. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn, like me, they yearn for the flag too. And drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Just a mother in it. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So
99.5 FM WBAI. Yeah.
The cops on the highway out enforcing the law, protecting the public with a punch in the jaw. DA at the courthouse prosecuting the youth. Gonna get them a conviction, no matter about the truth. It's a corruption eruption. Corruption eruption. It's a corruption eruption. Corruption eruption. Holding to the mob, got the senator's son a cushy no-show job. Greedy corporations count their billions abroad in a banana republic that we call tax fraud. It's a corruption eruption. Corruption eruption. Corruption, eruption. Corruption, eruption. We're sick of commentators, irregulators, chicken stock brokers, video pokers, tax break churches, stock market lurches, inside traders, religious crusaders, nepotism, despotism, fortune tellers, snake oil sellers, bankers, wankers, leaky tankers, war on users, lifestyle choosers, warfare mongers, tabloid hungers, movie action, mass distraction, global warming, birth deforming. It's a corruption eruption. Corruption, eruption. It's a corruption, eruption. It's a corruption, eruption on this island.
Benefits of Mr. Kites, there won't be a show tonight on trampoline. The Hendersons will all be there, Layla Pablo, Frank Astaire, Wallace. Over men and horses, hoops and glances, lustily through a hog's head of real fire. In this way, Mr. K will change the world. Crazy Mr. K performs his feat on Saturday at Bishop's Gate. The Hendersons will dance and sing as Mr. K flies through the ring. Don't be late. Mrs. K and H assure the public their production will be second to none. And of course, Henry the Horse dances with one of his arms. Yes, rock your feet and dance. Crowd of people full of enjoyment. Rock your feet and dance. Have you ever become bringing out the place? Rock your feet and dance. Rock your feet and, rock your feet and, rock your feet and dance.
At exactly 10 minutes after 3 o'clock, love seeing Jim Croy, Rubber Dub right here at 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio at its very best. Yes.
The band begins at 10 to 6 when Mr. K performs his tricks with Alice Sound. Mr. H will demonstrate in Somerset he'll undertake on solid ground. Having been some days in preparation, a splendid time is guaranteed for all. And tonight Mr. Kite is topping the bill.
trees like a